1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio with the stories behind history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard with your invitation to A Night at the Opera with your hosts Brian May and Roger Taylor of the Regal Rockers Queen.
Mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me. For me.
Sat down that night very late, maybe 2 a.m, and watched in video machines were just invented then, of the Marx Brothers' A Night at the Opera. Freddie and I turned round to each other, remember, and said, "Cool, that's a good title," because we'd just been doing this mock operetta.
I'm in love.
Was sort of life or death, and it was definitely sink or swim. If that album hadn't done what it did, that would have been the end of the band without any question.
It's easy to gamble when you've got nothing to lose.
That's right. It was just like, you know, we have to do what we do, and if we die, then we die by our own mistakes and no one else's.
Hi, this is Roger Taylor of Queen.
Hello, this is Brian May from Queen.
We're in the studio for A Night at the Opera.
It took a while for Queen to conquer America. In their native England, Queen was a sensation almost from the moment they released their first album in 1973. But it wasn't until their fourth album that Queen got a hold on the colonies. That album was A Night at the Opera. It wasn't the kind of record that most people would have expected to be a hit. A Night at the Opera was filled with odd arrangements and vocal effects, little bits of ukulele and banjos and campy burlesque show tunes. And Bohemian Rhapsody, the album's most famous song, was of course a mock operetta. Queen had evolved from a band called Smile, which featured guitarist Brian May and drummer Roger Taylor. In 71, May and Taylor joined forces with singer Freddie Mercury, born Farrokh Bulsara in Zanzibar to Persian parents. And along with bass player John Deacon, Queen was born. The first two albums, simply called Queen and Queen 2, went virtually unnoticed in the United States, and their third, Sheer Heart Attack, had only limited success. They were depending on A Night at the Opera to finally make them stars in America, as Brian May and Roger Taylor recall.
Yeah, it was sort of life or death. I mean, it was definitely sink or swim. If that album hadn't done what it did, that would have been the end of the band without any question.
It's easy to gamble when you've got nothing to lose.
That's right. It was just like, you know, we have to do what we do, and if we die, then we die by our own mistakes and no one else's.
I'm
You're My Best Friend from 1975's A Night at the Opera turned out to be a big hit for Queen. They were one of the first bands to successfully combine the art rock pretensions of England's progressive bands with a hard rock bass. On stage, Freddie Mercury's prancing and preening was a riveting counterpoint to Brian May's soaring guitar. Queen was one of the first bands to effectively bridge the gap between hard rock and glam rock, between art rock and the bad boy blues. Here's drummer Roger Taylor.
I would say we wanted to do the harmonic things, but better, that hopefully. Vocally, that yes, we're doing, but combine that with the wonderful, brutal, heavy influence of what Led Zeppelin were doing. And that was at the time we started. Obviously, we changed as we went along. But I would say that more than anything else, we wanted to combine those two sort of genres. With the second album, Queen 2, I think we sort of we did everything that we could possibly think of doing, and to the point of where we almost overcomplicated things. And I think we were starting to refine it down by then. And actually, Sheer Heart Attack is one of my own personal favourites, the album. And I think as a whole album, it stands up as well as anything we've ever done, really. Maybe other albums sold more, but for me, that's one. It's a very sort of clear statement. We'd started that was the one that first found a sort of unified and slightly stripped down direction.
And the kitschy, almost vaudevillian nature of some of Queen's playful tunes showed a humorous theatricality. Again, Queen drummer Roger Taylor.
I suppose that was our idea of making it not just typical rock and roll, you know. And I think we, in our own minds, we were always doing it with a slight tongue in cheek, you know. It was always not completely serious, but just interesting, we thought, more interesting to slide those references in, and in a sort of humorous way to us, I suppose that wasn't an obvious thing to other people listening, but it just for us, it made it one step away from your average hard rock album, you know, just to give it that extra dimension of interest, really, and sort of another musical influence.
Queen guitarist Brian May recalls the days just before recording their fourth album, A Night at the Opera.
We were all desperately scribbling away at the time. You know, we had a very high output, each of us separately, and there was a big struggle to sort of find out which things would go on the album. And it was a time of great release for us because we just almost had to sort of give up hope because we got into such terrible management problems, and we were totally broke, and we just signed a new management deal which was going to relieve us of all our debts. And this was a guy called John Reed, who's Elton's manager, and he said, look, I'll deal with all your troubles, go away and make an album. So we did, and the stuff just flowed out with a great sense of relief, and there was loads and loads of it.
Drummer Roger Taylor wrote a song on which Roger took a rare lead vocal called I'm in Love with My Car.
The guy used to mix our sound, our out front sound, and our sort of very dedicated, lifelong roadie at the time, he'd stuck with us through all the hard times, was a guy called John Harris. And really, he didn't have a girlfriend. He didn't like to eat much. He wasn't interested in stamps or drinking or any of the normal interests of life, really, you know. But he would wash his car a lot. And he was very interested and fond of his car. I like cars myself, and I can relate to that. I find my car a lot more interesting than my girlfriend most days. Has more to say to me. It takes me to places, you know, it's actually of some use.
going into Night at the Opera, you guys were busted broke. You were skint.
No, absolutely. I remember we had very little money.
And is all this was speculative, trying to launch your career?
It was entire speculation, really. If you look back, there was no guarantee they were ever going to get any money back on that. And Night at the Opera, I mean, the fact that the Sheer Heart Attack was a hit album, quite a big hit, we didn't see any money. And I think that, you know, it just sort of magically disappeared into our bank manager's swimming pool, I think. Yeah. But into our manager's swimming pool and his new Rolls Royce. But so when we recorded A Night at the Opera, we were broke, and so it was such a gamble, and we knew that this is it, you know, this better work, and especially with a song like Bohemian Rhapsody, it's such a chance to take.
Truth be told, history came perilously close to being rewritten for Queen that summer '74. Here's guitarist, singer, songwriter Brian May.
Plus, I got very sick. You know, there was all that going on. You know,
what happened?
I somehow got hepatitis when we were doing that first support tour with Mott the Hoople.
Oh, with Mott. And so, how do you deal over the spring and summer with a serious illness?
Well, we got to New York, which was one of the pinnacles, and did the Eurus Theatre, thank God. Sort of a Broadway kind of expedition for Mott, which we shared. And, you know, it was good of them to share it with us, really. And then off we went to Boston, and I woke up completely yellow.
Oh, my.
And feeling really, really bad.
Jaundiced.
Yeah, and nobody knows how it happened. I don't know how I got that hepatitis thing.
It happens just from close quarters. It happens to kids when they go away to college and they live in a dorm room together.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. So they shipped me back home, and that was the end of that tour, which was really sad for everybody. But, you know, everyone dealt with it really well. I didn't get any resentment from the rest of them. And then following that, I was sort of recovering from that. And then we started work on the album. And I was thrown up every, few times a day.
Oh, man.
And we started thinking, well, this is not the hepatitis. I'm sort of over that. What is this? And I ended up on the floor of this specialist's clinic in a bad way. And he said, I think we better take you in. And in King's College Hospital, they operated on me the next day because I had basically an extreme form of ulceration of the stomach.
Mm.
And it was
you
extreme.
You can die from that.
I would have died without a doubt.
Bleed internally.
Yeah, well, not just that, but also, if you want to know the details, there was so much ulceration, which had been going on since I'd been a child, apparently.
Really?
That nothing was getting through my body, basically.
Gosh.
So I was eating food, and it couldn't get out.
Oh.
So it had to come back up. Are you enjoying this explanation?
Bless your heart.
Yeah, so I was in no wonder I was in a pitiful state, you know. So they fixed it up. They sort of replumbed my insides. And
I didn't realize that you'd had surgery.
Between these
two dates and done a studio, your best studio album to date in Sheer Heart Attack.
Yeah, well, there's an irony in the Sheer Heart Attack title there, you know, because I owe my life to those people.
Wow.
In King's College. So that was quite serious, and I was in hospital, and we were halfway through the album, so Freddie and Roger and John would pop in and make me laugh, which would almost
hurt.
Kill me, because I had this huge incision down my middle. Yeah, don't make me laugh, guys. Oh, thanks. And but they brought me in the tapes of what they were doing, and they were continuing with the record. But I remember Freddie saying, "Don't worry, darling. You know, we're not going to finish it without you. We need you back." Freddie was great. He was very supportive, always. You know, he's very caring.
Love of my life, you've hurt me. You've broken my heart, and now you. Of my life, can't you see? Bring it back, don't take it away from me, because you don't know what it means to me. don't leave me. You've taken my love, you now desert me. Love of my life, can't you see?
Please bring
it back, bring it back. Don't take it away from me, because you don't know what it means to me.
And it took rockers like me years to appreciate fully the once-in-a-generation greatness that was Freddie Mercury's voice. But there it was, boldly on display on A Night at the Opera with Love of My Life. Brian May and Roger Taylor return in a moment to explain the inspiration for that album title. And coming later, we'll also hear from the most coveted Queen live performance at Christmastime 1975 in London's Hammersmith, now an official release as A Night at the Odeon. Click it now for download from iTunes and CD vinyl now from Amazon.com. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Queen's Brian May and Roger Taylor. A Night at the Opera.
I'm Roger Taylor of Queen.
Hi, this is Brian May from Queen. And welcome back to In the Studio.
And I'm Redbeard for the 5th anniversary of A Night at the Opera, ranked number 226 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 albums of all time. There's a progressive rock tour de force on the album, which was written by Queen guitarist Brian May, called The Prophet Song.
That actually did come from a dream, which is strange to relate and sounds extremely pseudo-rock star-ish, I don't know. But I did have this strange dream and wrote the lyrics around that. I was just coming out of a period where I got very ill when we were making the previous album. I think it was at about that time that I had this strange vision, and the song got written around that. But there was a lot of collaboration. And also I think I was very very fussy and pig-headed about it, and we spent ages and ages trying out to... I mean, they'll all tell you, I'm a horrible sod to work with. There was a lot of stuff which got put in there because I couldn't let the thing go. I remember having reams and reams of paper with little bits scribbled on them and yards of cassette material, and I didn't want to let any of the little ideas go. I don't think I could be that like that in these days because it drives you mad. But you have to... I had this feeling like you had to explore every little corner before you could let it go. It was a bit of a nightmare, to be honest.
I dreamed I saw the moonlit stage.
fires of hell.
Hell will take you.
Should death await you. Oh, people, can you hear me?
Here's Queen guitarist Brian May.
I had this fascination for delays, which would make a sort of canon effect, and we use it on guitars, like in Brighton Rock, and I wanted to use it on the voice as well. And at one time, we had Freddie just experimenting for hours, seeing what happened when the thing came back and he sang with it, you know, making harmonies and all sorts of progressions. And somehow that all... It would take longer to explain than we have. longer time, somehow in my mind that all fitted into what the song was trying to say. I think we always had this thing about the song coming first. And if the song would come in, we'd say, well, that doesn't need to be forced into a standard rock and roll mode. We should do what the song demands. So we would bring in all kinds of instruments and play around with them. And sometimes the text just got very mixed up and it was very, very us, I suppose. Yeah, we felt very free because we had a nice... We had an audience who understood us and didn't want us to make the same kind of sound every time. With each of us, we would come in and say, look, trust me, I have this kind of this amount worked out. You know, go along with it. And we would be going, oh, okay, okay. There was a separate beginning to each song. And then there was some, I'd say there was some collaboration, like the middle of Bohemian Rhapsody, the solo and everything we fiddled around with. But then it would be, you know, it would go back to its creator in the beginning, and it would still be that person's song. And if that person felt like the collaborative stuff hadn't been quite right, you would kick it out. I think that's why, at the time, it made sense to have it credited to separate people on the whole. And one person would always be responsible for all the lyrics of that song.
Compare the progressive rock bombast of the Prophet song by Brian May with another simple toe-tapping pub sing-along from Brian called 39.
It's a science fiction song. It's about a man who goes off... Well, I suppose that's obvious. I'm not sure if it's obvious or not, but he goes off time travelling. Well, he goes off space travelling, and because he goes around in a circle very fast, he suffers a special... a general relativistic effect, which means that when he comes back, he's been away 100 years, but he's only a year older. So that's what the song was about, sort of love song set in that context. And it came out, for some reason, like a skiffle song. It came out very quickly. I remember just strumming a guitar and the words came, mostly.
In the year of 39, assembled here the volunteers. In the days when lands were few, here the ships sailed out into the blue and sunny morn. Sweetest sight ever seen. Never cry. Don't you hear my call? Though you're many years away. Don't you hear me calling you? Write your letters in the sand for the day I take your hand in the land that our grandchildren knew.
Brian May, vocal as well as acoustic and electric guitars. That's a song called 39 from Queen's 1975, A Night at the Opera. Next, Brian May and Roger Taylor describe the first time Freddie Mercury presented his iconic song Bohemian Rhapsody to the rest of the band. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and never miss an episode at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Brian May and Roger Taylor, Queen's A Night at the Opera.
I'm Roger Taylor of Queen.
Hi, this is Brian May from Queen, and welcome back to In the Studio.
And I'm Redbeard for A Night at the Opera's 8th anniversary. In 1975, Queen was convinced by their new manager that the best way out of debt was to tour relentlessly in between recording an album a year. Here's Brian May.
And there was a chemistry happening with the band. You know, we discovered that we did work off each other very well, and the band had sort of come to, I think, its first period of real maturity, having done we had done some touring, as you know, and we discovered that we fitted into it very well. The band had a life, you know, it had a life of its own, which was indisputable, and you hardly stopped to think what it was. You just knew it was there and that you were doing something which felt right.
Here's Roger.
And the first album we ever made, Brian did a lot of stuff on guitar with featuring specific harmony guitars, which is a fairly new thing at the time. And a lot of the reviews in England, I can quote one, Chris Welch in the Melody Maker, a paper never known for its accuracy, in fact, famous for its inaccuracy, I might add, said a great use of synthesizers here. And of course, it was all guitar, and that which sort of got up our noses quite a lot. So we made a point, and the synthesizers at the time were monophonic. You couldn't play chords on them. We tried fiddling about with a big ARP in the studio once, and all we could get was something that you could make with your own body, you know, a noise that you could make better.
And a toilet roll.
Yeah, with your own body. And with, you know, more organic sort of overtones to it. So we was a bit put off by the early synthesizers and decided that we would actually say from then on, I think we said it for the next four albums or so, that we had no synthesizers on those albums. And it became a bit of a little thing, you know. We'd just actually started the song Bohemian Rhapsody, which had the mock operetta in the middle. And by sheer coincidence, we sat down that night very late, maybe 2 a.m, and watched a video. Video machines were just invented then, of the Marx Brothers' A Night at the Opera. Freddie and I turned round to each other, I remember, and said, "Cool, that's a good title," because we'd just been doing this mock operetta. And then we said, I think, to everybody else, and everybody went, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." So that was the idea. And we had this, we'd already had this sort of operatic, mock operatic content. And so that seemed the natural direction.
I see a little silhouette of a man.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo,
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 Galileo Figaro.
Magnifico.
I'm just a poor boy and nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family. Spare him his life from this monstrosity.
Easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Bismillah!
No, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah!
We will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah!
We will not let you go.
Let me go!
We'll not let you go.
Let me
never,
go!
Never, never, let you
never,
go.
Never let me go!
Mamma mia, mamma mia,
mamma mia, let me go.
Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me, for me, for me.
I must say, with Bohemian Rhapsody, that was a particular song which Freddie came in one day. He had it written completely down on the backs of telephone books. He had every harmony written, and I think he had the entire thing mapped out mentally. He knew exactly how he wanted it to sound. So that is one song, really, but it belonged to him. Half the time, we didn't really quite know what the totality of what it was going to be when we were playing it. So, I mean, that was amazing. There were enormous harmonies in there, and he really had most of it in his head beforehand.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open. open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy, I need no sympathy, because I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little low. Anyway the wind blows doesn't really matter to
just gotta
Queen drummer Roger Taylor assesses the impact of their 1975 album A Night at the Opera, followed by Brian May.
I would say it cemented our worldwide success. We'd had limited success to an extent with A Sheer Heart Attack, the album before that. But I think A Night at the Opera sort of seriously cemented that in a wider context, you know. It was a very big album in England. And sort of everywhere, really, I think. And it had consolidated what we'd done in America. We just started, really, with the third album. So it was the sort of clincher, in a way, in the early stage of our career.
We took a lot of risks, and that was always the name of the game, I suppose. And Bohemian Rhapsody in particular, everybody said, you can't put that out as a single. It's too long, and it doesn't fit any of the formats. And we said, well, that's what we're putting out, and we're not changing it, we're not editing it. So we were very full of ourselves, I suppose, and hardly stopping to think about, you know, what the plan was. We were just somehow pushing on, and it all seemed very clear.
There's no plan, really. It was just what happened, you know, as it happened.
The song Bohemian Rhapsody and the album A Night at the Opera paved Queen's way to superstardom the first time 35 years ago. Years later, Bohemian Rhapsody would set a new record for being number one in England for 9 weeks in a row. The song was chosen for a centerpiece scene in the Saturday Night Live spin-off Mike Myers and Dana Carvey hit comedy film Wayne's World. But just mere weeks before the film and its soundtrack containing Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody would be the number one movie and album in America, lead singer Freddie Mercury died of AIDS in 1992. Earlier, I had asked Brian May if Queen had envisioned A Night at the Opera's impact.
I'll be very honest with you, I never really thought of myself as a rock guitarist until about a year ago, and I suddenly thought, you know, and I discovered it when I thought it wasn't going to happen anymore. I felt like I was falling to pieces, and I thought, well, I've never really admitted that I was a rock star up to this point. I thought I was just maybe a student. I thought I was this guy who was sort of trying to choose his career, and he was, you know, playing his guitar for a while. And I suddenly thought, well, for the last few years, I've actually been this person that other people think is a rock star, you know. So it was all a great sort of source of happiness to us. You know, it wasn't like a job, and it wasn't like, you know, we have to succeed. We always just assumed that we would succeed, and we would, you know, people would eventually realise how wonderful we were. But again, as Roger said, slightly tongue-in-cheek, because it's on different levels. On one level, you think you can conquer the world, and you're quite confident of it. And on the other level, you see everybody else is out there having records plays, and you haven't the slightest idea how to get into the business. So there's a very mixed emotions. On one level, we thought, yeah, of course it's going to be a hit. And on one level, I think it was just a joyful surprise.
Now then, we're going to do a nice tasty little medley for you, just like the one we did the other day, yes. And we're going to start off with a little segment from a number called Bohemian Rhapsody. Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, now he's dead. Mama, life had just begun, but now I've gone and thrown it all away. Mama, ooh, didn't mean She keeps them away, Shonda, in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cake, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. Building a remedy, crucial and Kennedy at any time. Invitation you can't decline. Caviar, cigarettes, well versed in etiquette. Extraordinarily nice, she's a killer. Queen, gunpowder, eternity, dynamite with a laser beam. And appetite, wanna try? To avoid complications, she never kept the same address. In conversation, she spoke just like a baroness. Little man from China went down to Geisha Mana. Then again, incidentally, you're that way inclined. Perfume came naturally from Paris. She couldn't care less, fastidious, precise. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, eternity, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Anytime, command another price, satiable and appetite. Wanna try?
A Night at the Odeon, the medley with Bohemian Rhapsody mashed up with the first hit by Queen, Killer Queen. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Brian May and Roger Taylor of Queen. Special thanks to Paul Rappaport. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.